Hello and welcome. I'm Laura Briggs with the Vegan Fitness Runner podcast, where I'll be talking all things running, health and fitness, and what it means to be an active vegan.
Ben Garrard is not only my friend and fellow hatchling, but he's also a pretty clever scientist, evolutionary biologist, presenter, dinosaur, and ape expert. He loves a challenge, and he's already lined up more big runs, so I wanted to pick his brains about the science behind running.
Ben Garrard, hello, how are you?
I'm not too bad, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you. It seems like a long time ago I last saw you.
It feels both a lifetime ago and it feels like it was this morning.
I'm not sure which is better, actually. Possibly a lifetime ago. I think you probably had enough.
I think so. It's weird, isn't it, how it was so very much all-consuming, all-encompassing, and every part of your life was focused on the next step or the next 2 or 3 hours. And we just stepped away from that really quickly. It was a really, really bizarre experience.
Yeah, we should probably just explain that we both ran the Hatchling on the Dragon's Back, didn't we? Pretty much together. I mean, you were faster than me, but we stuck together quite a lot, didn't we?
You said there were some bits you were ahead of me and some bits I were ahead of you. And I think it was the nice thing was we came together like a little fellowship of five of us weird, dorky runners who just found each other and made an amazing event even more fun, actually. I think, for me, when people say, what was the best bit? What was your highlight? And I think they mean geographically. It was hanging out with other people like me. It was really nice.
Hanging out with other strange people with running poles who look slightly like the Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah, it was like a really budget version of Lord of the Rings, wasn't it?
Hang on, less of the budget. Thank you. Ben, tell me, what got you into running, first and foremost?
I was born and raised up in or over in Norfolk on the East Coast, and mum and dad live right by the sea. And when I was really young, and like 12, 13, 14, I'd take my dog for a walk in the morning, we'd go on the beach, then I'd come back, and then I would go out for a run on the beach, then I'd come back, then I'd go to school. And that was before university when I stopped doing all those things. But I just really enjoyed running on the beach. I enjoyed running outdoors and having nature all around me. And then I grew up and went to uni and as most of us do, unfortunately, become less healthy when we get to uni. And things just sort of slipped away. And then I moved away and lived in Africa and did all my other stuff. And I stopped running for years and years and years. Then I hit my late 30s and I developed, it's going to sound like a really sob story now, developed like a weird arthritis in my neck. And long story short, an amazing surgeon here in Bristol operated the first week of lockdown in 2020 and fused some of my vertebrae together, took a load of extra bone away and sorted me out. And I woke up and all the pain I'd had for about 3, 4, 5 years and the limited mobility had completely gone. And the one thing I wanted to do, Laura, was get back to running. So I did the couch to 5K, then I did my first 10K, and then I did my first half marathon. And at one point I just thought, I'm really enjoying this. I don't feel creaky and old, and I don't feel arthritic, and my knees are fine. And being the scientist I am, I thought, well, how far can I take this? If I learn to run sensibly with my science head on, what's stopping me doing a marathon or even maybe an ultra marathon? And that was it, really.
You say that science-y head of yours, and I think, oh, maybe you are a bit sensible because you're a scientist, but actually I have my doubts now. Do you think that you maybe push yourself further than most people would?
When you say most people, I think most people I know, I think, have an element of that. I mean, you are a very good case in point here. You're exactly the same. I think a lot of us out there want to push ourselves in different ways. And I think a subset of us want to push ourselves. It's easy to say physically, because something like the Dragon's Back, which I'm sure you've told your listeners is from North to South Wales over 6 days and twice Everest and blah, 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 and all these terrible, horrific statistics physically. But I think mentally it was more demanding for me. But I think quite a lot of us want to push ourselves physically and mentally. Probably more than some people, but less than others, I guess. I don't know.
And maybe because of the arthritis and the pain that you used to be in, do you think maybe that's just been that extra catalyst to push yourself even further and to show that you can do great things now because you're not in any pain anymore?
Maybe, yeah. I think maybe I'm making up for lost time a little bit. I used to love my swimming, used to love my running, and just being more active. And for several years, I couldn't swim more than a couple of lengths in my local pool. I definitely couldn't run more than a couple of K. And if I did, I'd be in pain the next day. And then that had knock-on effects. I probably ate too much. I probably drank too much, to be fair. And then stopped drinking in 2020. And then just decided to really get fit, really. Am I doing that to help sort of cut lost time? Yeah, probably. It's not to prove anything. I really don't need to prove anything to me or anyone else. But actually, I think I'm in a lucky position where right now I'm able to do a lot of the things I wasn't able to do before. So yeah, I'm going to crack on. I've got no reason not to. And I don't know about you. We talked about this, didn't we? This whole, why are you doing the dragon's back in those dark, terrible moments? Remember your why. And a few of us said, well, there isn't a why. There's a why not. Why wouldn't I do it? What's stopping me? Why can't I do it? I can afford to do it and I can afford the time and I'm healthy enough. Why wouldn't you do something like this?
Yeah, I think there was definitely one moment where we all looked at each other slightly guiltily and thought, oh my God, I haven't figured out my why yet. I need a why. And then we kind of realised, no, the why is, why not? Let's just do it because we can.
Yeah, I think that's a really strong motivator. I think rather than this whole, I need to prove it for myself or my family or my community or my sex or whatever, which are all really valid points. I think we don't always need that really strong defining sort of raison d'etre, the whole what gets you up in the morning. It's like, I've got no reason not to. Like, say, if you can do these things, it should be our baseline. It's like organ donation. Weird comparison there. We shouldn't have to go, I've decided to try and help someone else. I've decided to make society better. You're like, that should be default. You should be a good person and try and help others where you can. It shouldn't be an active decision. And I think the same for challenges sometimes. We're here, what, between 70 and 90 years, most of us, hopefully, all going, well, I don't want, either that classic line, I don't want to get to the end and sort of dawdle into my grave and go, oh, well, that was quite nice, but I'm glad I didn't do anything for the last 25 years, nice and safely. I want to skid to the edge and go, holy crap, that was scary. That was amazing. I'm covered in blood and cocktails and dirt. And that'd be perfect. That's why I want to do it. And I think more of us just need to just get off our bums and go, I've got no reason not to do these silly things right now. So crack on.
That's a really good message. And listen, you didn't just run the Dragon's Back race. You were also being poked and prodded every morning and every evening after you'd done your run. So can you explain a little bit about what all that was about?
Yes. So I am a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of East Anglia. And very luckily, I've got a whole bunch of friends and colleagues around the country, around the world, I guess, who work in academia, but around the country in particular. And some of those are based over in Wales. And Laura Mason and Nick Owen, who are both in charge of the sports science department over there, are brilliant. And we got talking about a year and a bit ago now, and I said, look, I'm doing this really stupid race. I don't know why I'm doing it. I haven't thought of my reason why yet, obviously, blah blah blah, backwards and forwards. They said, well, do you want to come measure your baselines? I said, yeah, I kind of do, actually, because I don't know whether, well, I know it's a stupid idea, but I don't know how stupid this is. They said, look, we can do some cardiovascular stuff, we can do echocardiograms, we can run you through your paces, and it'll be quite nice. To make it legit is to see how you progress over your next year or so, or 18 months of training. And I said, okay, that sounds really cool. They said, there's not much information on long distance runners and endurance. And he said, endurance athletes. They keep calling me endurance an athlete, which is a really horrible term because it fills you with the sense of imposter syndrome. They kept saying, we don't have endurance athletes who are happy for us to follow them and do data collection over a period of time. And being an academic myself and a runner, I've got nothing to lose. I don't really care. So I said, yeah, more the merrier. Come along and take some data across these leading 12 months. And then we got closer to the race itself. And they said, I don't suppose we could come along to the race and take bloods and blood gases and urine and do cognitive tests every morning and every night. And again, me being me, said, yeah, it's fine. That won't interfere with my running at all. And it interfered with my running so much. But in a good way, actually. It was a few times I just got back to camp with you guys and I was dying to go and grab a tea and a plate of chips and just chill out and relive the day. And I instead had to go and do cognition tests and pee into a tube and take bloods and everything. But it was a really nice pilot study that we're still collating the data that we want to go back next year, more likely the year after now, and get a much wider group of participants to do morning and evening testing to see whether we can look at what sort of people run these races, what are just the body, what the recovery times are. And it can be used from everything from evolutionary adaptations in humans to endurance, athlete training, right through to things like hydration issues, and for all of us, actually. So it was a commitment, but it was a really fun commitment, actually. And it gave me a real personal insight into how I was doing each morning and each night. I'm fully aware, Laura, of how much you and the rest of them ribbed me that my cognition went completely downhill really quickly. Although, to be fair, I'm the only one that quantitatively knew that. I'm pretty sure the rest of us were doing just as badly, that I'm the only one that had the data, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I know that the results aren't in yet, but short term, it was quite funny to hear you saying, oh, yeah, I've been told that, like, basically, I can't even kind of add two and two anymore. And I can't, you know, I can't basically pick up a cup of tea. And everything just stopped working, didn't it, for a while?
It really did. And what was really actually the only bit that was disconcerting, I mean, the hydration, surprisingly, even though it was in that really hot week we had, the heat, the big sort of heat wave, I thought my hydration would be completely gone out the window. I thought my dehydration levels would be up, and they were a little bit high, and a few other things that you'd expect. But the one that really got me was my cognition completely tanked, as you said. But my perception of my cognition hadn't changed at all. I remember seeing you on day three or four walking into the canteen going, I thought I did really well. I've just told them that I thought I smashed a cognition test, so I aced it. And I'd gone really downhill. And like you said, I was barely capable of stringing a sentence together. But it was that miscommunication between my perception of my cognition, my actual cognition. And that really made me think that this is where runners and people under stress go wrong. We think we're doing okay, and suddenly you don't hydrate as much, or you don't have that extra gel or that fuel, or you make a wrong turn. And I can see that's being applicable to driving long distances, and not only running long distances, but a whole bunch of different things. So yeah, it was a really interesting little pilot study that hopefully we can expand on when we get funding over the next couple of years to make it a standard thing that we can start to assess what it is that allows us to run these big races. And the team themselves said it's really surprising. And I'm sure you saw this, Laura, of all the different ages and shapes and sizes, there isn't a standard runner, in inverted commas. There isn't that lithe, tall, lanky 24-year-old. It was all shapes, all sizes, all ages, all doing really well. What is it, though, from a scientific point of view, that ties us all together? There's a bunch of things that allows us to do that. Even though we might not look the same or act the same or feel the same, we will have similarities that allow us to do these things.
For sure. And I think on that week as well, there was a lot of luck involved. I mean, you're saying about the different shapes and sizes and, you know, different forms of athletes. I'm going to call myself an athlete now. Why
there
not?
You are.
You know, the people that you looked at perhaps and thought they're going to win it, they really struggled that week. And people who perhaps you might have thought would have struggled did really well. So there's no one size fits all, is there, for endurance running?
No. And this is the thing. I mean, there will be an element of luck, of course, but equally, there will be some things that we haven't anticipated yet that we could look at more. So it might be something completely off the radar that we're not thinking about, or it could be as simple as keeping on top of the hydration and fueling and cleaning your feet and drying it with the cognition. So it might be associated with cognition. Those of us who are cognitively better might do better at these long distance races as those who aren't maybe doing these things, or vice versa. Until we look at these things, we just don't know. But that's the fun. I mean, it was fun enough. I say fun. Most of it was fun enough that week anyway.
But type 2 fun, yeah, I think they call it.
I think it was type 3 fun, Laura, actually, at one point. But equally, it was quite fun to have that sense of your own personalized little set of data collecting going on at the same time. And hopefully we can expand that to really, I don't know, not only to understand why the existing community is already there, but how to enable others to come and do this. Because I don't know about you, but for me, it was so lovely to see so many of us who aren't long distance runners for the last 30 years, who are expert, who are elite, any of the words that I think intimidate the average runner out there. And I think it really helped show me, at least, it really did show me, actually, that we all have more potential than I thought we did in terms of these big, crazy, long-distance, multi-day runs. I actually thought, I've got no chance of finishing this. I kept saying to you, oh yeah, I've entered this with full anticipation, I'm going to finish this. But there was every part of me thinking, I don't know what I've done. I don't know why I've done this. I'm not ready for this. This is ridiculous. But actually, if we can unlock some of those key attributes that allow the average runner to tackle bigger events like this, that can only be a good thing.
You obviously have a very analytical mind, and you're a scientist, as we've said before. Do you think a lot harder about what you eat and what you drink and how much you rest before you do an event like this?
So I literally measured out every calorie that I took into this race, and I had two clear bags for every day, morning and night. It was a combination of gels and rehydration sachets and electrolytes and salt tablets and solids and a couple of treats in there each time. So I completely analysed the hell out of my game before this, and then got there and it all went completely bad because I couldn't eat anything solid because it was so bloody hot. We were all just drinking gels and just licking sweat off sheep and stuff like this. It was just awful because none of us wanted to eat anything solid. So yeah, I think that's where the luck comes into this. I think it was bad luck for a lot of us. I think hydration completely screwed a load of us up on that race, because as well planned as you can be, I definitely hadn't anticipated it would be so hot that we physically couldn't eat solids during the race. So I had these every day. I came back with huge amounts of these chews and these bars and these protein bars and these fiber bars. I just couldn't stomach. And whereas I typically don't, I'm not a big fan of gels, I was dreaming about gels. I can all think they're the best flavor in the world. Oh, they're the tastiest thing. It's like amber or nectar for the gods, these gels. I tried one of my first 10K again when I got back, and it was rank yet again. But it's I think it just showed us that with all the planning in the world, it doesn't always go to plan, sadly.
That's true. And gels are disgusting as well, in my opinion. Now, look, there was one moment during that race when you had another dream. We've got to talk about it, where you basically unlocked the key to running. Do you remember?
Yeah, of course I do. Do I remember?
Tell everyone about that, yeah.
I'm hoping to talk to Deborah Mead in Dragon's Den about pitching this or selling this. I think when I told you this as well, I was still partly convinced this might actually be a thing. So I was still keen to test this out. I woke up one morning, and what was weird, I don't know about you, but you would wake up at 4 a.m.-ish, and then you'd get up, you would do all your sort of morning ablutions, and you'd get ready, and you'd have your kit checked, you'd have your food. And it was very automatous, where you weren't really thinking. So I think that time between waking up and actually running was a bit of a dreamlike state anyway. So I was going out in the first hour or so each morning, really not with it. I'm not a morning person. I know that for a fact. So it took me a while to warm up each morning. I'm convinced that I still thought this was possible. So I dreamt one night really, really lucidly that I had unlocked the way to run. And this is after 2 days of, I think it was 2 days of running through Wales, that all you had to do was take one step every 5 seconds. But the steps were so big that each step would last 5 seconds in the air. So it was very, actually what it would do, it would slow down time. So I remember waking up one morning in my dream and going out running with you and the rest of the gang, and I was showing you how to run. I was like, guys, look, watch. And I would just bound off like a cloud, only touch the ground every 5 seconds. And you were all going, oh my God, that's amazing. You all trying it and you all did it. And we just bounced really lightly all the way down Wales. And it was just wonderful. It was honestly, it was just like amazing. And I woke up next morning convinced that was real. And it was only when you really hammered at home that wasn't a possibility that I might have been dreaming. So I was quite upset to realise that wasn't possible, Laura. But thanks for making me relive that one.
We were all really excited by the possibility that this might be a thing. But it never really came to fruition, did it? It was still really hard. And we still didn't kind of get the running, to that level, I would say.
No, not quite to that level. I mean, if anyone listening does ever, I mean, give it a try. I mean, I'm always interested in changing cadence and changing pace. If you can make one step every 5 seconds, I reckon like Kipchoge and the rest of them will be all over that.
I think it's a great concept. I'm definitely, maybe tomorrow I might give it another go, because maybe we're just too tired to make it work.
You know, the worst thing is every time I run since, it at some point I can guarantee the whole concept of float running pops into my head and I completely lose my mojo when I'm running, because it just hits me that I could still want to try and see
float
if I can
running.
Float running.
It's got a new name and everything.
Yeah, I've got t-shirts, everything. I'm branded. Don't worry.
Love it. Now, we just briefly touched on your kind of your dietary requirements for the dragon's back, which went totally out the window. You're a vegetarian, right?
I am, yeah.
Is that for any particular reason? Is that a health thing? Is that because you think you are fitter and better at running as a vegetarian, or have you always been that way?
I was a veggie for a long time. I'd say when I was a kid, I wasn't. So mum and dad, very traditional in meat and two veg sort of family that I grew up in. But working or wanting to be a zoologist or sort of a biologist as a kid, I was always very conscious that I didn't like eating animals. So as soon as I had the agency to, I stopped eating meat. And then I moved to Africa, and sounds flippant, but it's very hard to be a very, very poor culture and suddenly have these expectations where I'm sorry, I won't eat this, I can't eat this. I lived alongside the local community, and it was day in, day out for years, and I just ate what they ate, and that was normal to me. But actually, we killed our own animals, so it was very much a transitional, very, very, we raise the animals, we kill them when we need to. That was very, in quite a way, if you're going to eat meat, quite a nice way of doing it. And then I stopped again when I came back to the UK, and then I sort of went backwards and forwards a little bit, and I used to make excuses and say I was flexitarian, all that rubbish. And then I was back out in Uganda quite a few years ago now, and in a chimpanzee sanctuary, and I was doing some work with the chimps, and I was about to have lunch, and it was goat or something like that, one of the local dishes, which I really like, or I used to really like the local dishes like this. And just as my order was made, it was going to take about 45 minutes, and I was going to have some sort of juices with my mates and colleagues out there. Someone found what they thought was a big dead lizard, about a 5.5 foot monitor lizard washed up on the shore. And they went to look at it, and as we went over, it moved its tail really gently. This whole thing was emaciated, its skin was parchment dry, and we took it to the veterinary clinic, and it had so many ticks and other parasites on it. It had drained this poor animal, quite literally, and it had become dehydrated. So again, long story short, I spent 3 hours removing ticks with alcohol and tweezers off this poor lizard, and then rehydrating it using saline under the skin. And you have to, with reptiles, do it in a pattern of every centimeter in a grid formation. So you have to do it sort of subcutaneously. So under the skin, pull the skin up, give it an injection, then nail another one, and another one, and another one, and another one. And I was eye to eye with this big orange eye that looked full of anger and hatred and didn't want me there at all. But equally, I was trying to save this thing. And just as I was finishing, someone said, your lunch is ready. And I thought, why am I saving this lizard when I'm about to go and eat a goat? It just made no sense to me whatsoever. And it really hit me. And I carried on with this poor old lizard that I eventually sent back into the water, and it swam off hours later. And that was it for me. It was this weird eye-to-eye afternoon with this very angry Nile monitor that completely put me off my meat forever, I'm afraid. I'm not afraid at all, but it was almost, I wish that come sooner. That's such a transcending moment, really.
It was a double happy ending, because the lizard lived and more goats now will live thanks to you not eating goat curry.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You spent a lot of time in Africa. How long were you out there in total?
So I went when I was 17. I mean, I loved my home life, but the moment I could leave, I was gone. I think I just about, 17, maybe just turned 18, and moved to Madagascar for just under a year. That was the furthest I thought I could get away from where I grew up. But I just wanted to go explore the world. And I hadn't really seen Madagascar on the news, and the films weren't out then, so I didn't know. Apparently it was full of lions and zebras escaped from zoos, which isn't true either. So I went to do some work out there, and then decided I was going to travel all through Africa afterwards. So I managed 2 weeks before I got malaria and got flown back to the UK. So that kind of put that one up the creek for a while. And then went to university. And then after my first uni experience, I went and lived in Uganda for just under 3 years, nearly. Right on the Congo border. I was working with wild chimps there, and then came back, spent about a year in the UK, then luckily got a job in Indonesia, in Sumatra, working with orangutans for just over a year, about 18 months, I guess, and the same sort of work out there. And then came back and I did my master's. I did a veterinary master's. And then weirdly, I had no money by this time, got a job in the Arctic as a tour guide. A really high-end tour, one of these tour companies showing people polar bears and walruses, which I was lovely, but I didn't really enjoy it. It was the environmental footprint of that was something I wasn't comfortable with. And actually, I realized that I don't like the cold as much as I like tropical jungles. So I, at least I tried these things. So I came back and then started a PhD, ended up working in the Caribbean for a while, looking at monkeys taken from Africa to the Caribbean. And now, since then, I work back in Africa. So I guess in total, 5 or 6 years in total, but that's now spread across a year. So last year, for example, I was in a whole bunch of West African countries for sometimes weeks and sometimes a lot longer, doing research and taking students out there and developing conservation and academic programs. So yeah, I guess Africa is, it's hard to generalize all of Africa, but Africa, I guess, is my where my heart lies, other than the UK sometimes. So yeah, I spent a lot of time out there.
I was going to say, do you feel yourself getting twitchy feet when you come back to the UK, just wanting to head off somewhere else again?
I used to. I really, really used to. And you could always tell if I'd been here more than 3 months. I'd get really antsy and I'd get quite short. Not with anyone else, but with myself. I was just, I need to get away. I just need to go and just go and find. And it's that red sandy soil that really gets into you, and it just gets into every crack and crevice and every under your nails, and it's just beautiful, it's wonderful, it's an amazing feeling. And then lockdown happened and it completely changed my horizons. So I still love going out and doing these wonderful things, but equally I just love being in the UK nowadays and exploring my own patch, my own doorstep. And I'm really keen that, I don't know about you, Laura, but I'm really keen that as much as possible as a runner, I try and do as much of my running on the British Isles as possible. There's so much. I mean, I looked at the Barclay Marathon is obviously an insane one. You've got some of these incredible North American marathons, and you've got the UTMB and all these wonderful things out there. And I want to do a lot of these things. The Marathon de Sable, who obviously one of our mates who ran with us, she did a couple of times. I want to do a lot of these things, but equally, I want to explore my own habitats, my own ecosystems in the UK. And obviously the carbon footprint's a big issue. Trying to be a green runner is an ethical thing, I guess, for many of us. So that sense of getting itchy feet and running away and having to go, I don't have any longer. And weirdly, I'm much happier with that. So when I do go to Africa, when I do go to these places, I feel like I really am happy that I'm there, that I've earned it, that I deserve to be there. But it's not a burning need that changes me if I don't get there anymore. So I'm much happier in my own skin, in my own sort of locale nowadays.
So do you think that thirst for travel and adventure is maybe quenched a bit more by you just going out and running in your own environment now?
Maybe. I think that's the same sort of thing on a different scale, that sense of escapism, that sense of sort of, it's like a cathartic solitude, I guess, where you can just disappear for an hour or 6 days or 6 weeks. It depends where you go and what you're doing. But I think having that sense of, where I used to go to Africa, for example, say in Uganda, you could go Uganda every year or every couple of years, and then other places as well. It was a real sense to get away from everything and just be at one with everything around me. And that was such a big hype thing in my head that I would look forward to it for, well, about a year and a half each time. Whereas the wild running, you can do every day if you want. You can do every, I mean, you had Jay on recently. Jay lives in Cornwall and there's some of the most beautiful wild places in Europe there. That's on his doorstep. So I think this idea that we can just go for a run is a really small snapshot of that bigger picture. So yeah, I think you're getting like a microdose of escapism every time you go for a run. I think if you make it that way, if you go and it's a slog and you don't look forward to it and it's you're doing it because you have to, I think that's really sad. But I get that for a lot of runners. But I think if more of us can realize this is a real escapism-based thing where, for positive reasons, you could just go and be in your own head, or you can listen to music, or go listen to a podcast, or go running with a mate, or whoever. I think that's really nice. So yeah, it's. I'm not saying it's filled a gap, because it is different for me, but it's definitely helping. It's helping me sort of manage my expectations, my needs more, I guess.
Yeah, you mentioned Jay Grady. He has the beautiful setting of Cornwall to run around. And he was saying, you know, for him, it is that level of solitude that he really, he really values and that he feels really blessed that he has that on his doorstep when so many people don't. And I think he really, you know, he cherishes that.
Absolutely. I think, when you say solitude, it's a hard one, isn't it? Because it's easy, not that easy. It's easy to find solitude when there's no one else around you. And that's not detracting from the beauty of where Jay lived, because I've been there. It's gorgeous. I used to live there, actually. It's a beautiful part of the world. But I did a 10K around Bristol last night, about 8 to 9 last night. And I ran, if you know Bristol at all, I ran, just skirted around the Downs, then ran down to Cheltenham Road and Gloucester Road, through the Bear Pit, through the city centre, around the harbour, up Park Street. These are busy places on a Sunday evening even. And yet it felt really quiet. And even running through crowds of people, you still have that sense of solitude. You're not talking to anyone. You're not engaging with anyone. But I think that's it. In a weird way, the same sort of run for me that as it is on the coast of Cornwall. Or I was in Norfolk the week before visiting my folks. I did a beautiful run along the beach. And I think I maybe saw one or two people across that. Again, another 10K or 12K on the beach. But it was that same feeling, that same sense of I'm on my own in this run. I think that's the thing, the beauty of running. You can be on your own with thousands of people around you in the same way that you're on your own where there's no one around you. And I think that's really nice for running.
Yeah, that's so true. And actually, you know, spending more time in areas near where you live is an adventure in itself, really. I think there's a lot of places that I feel I haven't explored enough near me. And sometimes I get this urge to go away and a run, like you said before, you know, do all these massive challenges that are far-flung places. But actually, we've got some amazing runs on our doorstep, haven't we?
We really have. And even when we say our doorstep, I mean, you and I live relatively close to each other, but we haven't even got to go over the border to Wales or down to Cornwall or I mean, literally on your doorstep. And I most of my running is around Bristol City. And I don't know most of the city still. And actually, for me, running, and I'm, as a man, I'm much more able to run at night. I'm very, very consciously aware of that, sadly. But most of my running is at nighttime. And actually exploring the city at night, I don't know half of where I'm going half the time. And that really surprises me. Because even if I catch the bus or drive or walk around, I know where I'm going usually because I've got a destination to go to. But I think the fun thing with running is I run in a big loop. So I know where I'm going. I'm going home eventually. But actually taking a slightly different route each time can be just as much of an adventure as the Mendips or as sort of southern Wales somewhere or around the coast anywhere. I think it is what you make it. And it's such a cliche thing to say, but you can run the same route every day and notice something different. Or you can run a different route every day and not notice anything around you. So it's up to you how connected you are to your run. I think the more connected you are, the more you enjoy it. So when I grew up on the beach, I would always take huge amounts of pride and comfort, actually, that I would notice that my little patch of the beach changed every day, and it changed across the hours in a day. So I never felt I was walking the same beach twice, even though it was the same beach every single day. And I think running can be like that for me. So I've got a whole bunch of regular runs that I do. So one's on the towpath underneath the Bristol Bridge, the Avon Gorge, near where I live. And although it's a nice track out to Pill and back, it is the same run, but it changes. It's changing. There were orchids a couple of months ago, and now the berries are here, and suddenly the birds will change, and all these things will change over that same run. And I think I think more of us could do with more of that, noticing what's around us. And running isn't about getting the best pace or getting the best speed or whatever, all these things. That's part of running, but unless you're going to be an elite runner, don't worry about your cadence and don't worry about your pace, all that rubbish. Just worry about enjoying the run you're on and noticing the world around you. Notice yourself, listen to yourself, breathe more. Just take the joy and live that moment. And again, it sounds really cliche, like I've swallowed the Clinton's cards, thesaurus, or spewing out sort of inspirational quotes here. But it's true, I think. I've really come to love running for the sake of running. And I think that took a long time, actually.
We love inspirational quotes, Ben. Don't ever worry about that. It's interesting you saying about running at night, because obviously you feel very safe running around Bristol. I guess it's pretty well lit as well. Where I am, there aren't street lights. You know, I'm straight out onto the trails, and it's pitch black. And that does change how a run feels to me. So if I can run somewhere in daylight and I can feel fine and I'm enjoying the day, and then I can perhaps attempt it at night and feel absolutely terrified and run so fast that I'm, you know, I'm dying by the time I've got home, because it just feels so different, but not necessarily in a good way.
And I think that's really sad. And I'm sorry. I'm really sorry, Laura, because that's not how it should be at all. And I think it honestly made my chest go tight when you just said that, because I've got, obviously you included, but I've got so many friends and colleagues and people I care about and love who can't do something so fundamentally simple as go for a run. And yes, I know there's bigger problems out there. Of course, there are terrible humanitarian things going on all around us right now. But equally, on our own doorstep, that you don't feel you can go and run in the same way that I can, or the same way that you can the daytime, doesn't reflect on you. I know you don't think that, but it doesn't reflect on you at all. It reflects on fundamentally men making you feel unsafe. And that's something we really need to work on. And you don't need to work on that at all. We need to work on that as a male community. And it's not just me saying, well, I've never chased a woman down the street while running. Of course I haven't. But equally, do I have friends who would wolf whistle? Do I have mates who would eye someone up and like, all right, sweetheart? That's just, if I don't call them out as well, and that's something so many of us are jumping on and trying to change. And it's not virtue signaling. Anyone listening going, oh, virtue signaling can piss off, basically. But we all need to do more to make those people we care about in our lives feel safer. And even if you go, oh, well, my mum, right? It's not about your mum or your sister or your daughter. It doesn't matter. It should be any woman out there, anyone who wants to go for a run, bloody deserves to be able to. So yeah, I think all we can do in many ways is call out those who aren't doing the right thing. But equally, I think what's really nice is if you're a bloke listening to this and you know you've got women who want to go for a run or do run, but you know they don't, offer to go with them. Offer to go and pick them up and take them out, or two or three of you do it, and go for a run, even something simple. Because if you enjoy night running, how much more would other people enjoy it as well? So it's something that we can all do a little bit more. And I've got mates who I've been running at night with. And it is a very different feel. And some people hate it. Some people love it. But if you feel safe and hate it, that's fine. If you don't feel safe and hate it, then we can work to hopefully change that. I would love that to be changed. And that's why groups like Running Punks and Running Clubs and all these other things are trying to change the narrative around this, but it's a bigger picture that we've all got to work at. So I am sorry, and it's something that's it's crap, and it shouldn't be the case at all. But yeah, I mean, I do enjoy my night running. I think it feels, what's the word, intimate. I think there's a real, I mean, I'm a very much a night person. I walk my dog at night. I like running at night. I used to thinking at night and just walking around thinking, solving things I couldn't work through. That's same for running for me.
I'd love to love running at night. And I think, you know, when it is street lit and if it's busy, then I do enjoy it. But yeah, I think if I run with one or two more people, then of course I feel safe and it's fine and I enjoy it. But yeah, running on my own is just, it's a different ball game. But that's not your fault, Ben, because you're obviously trying to change that.
Well, no, it's not. I'm not. It's not taking blame personally, but it's accepting that it's very easy for me to go, well, it's not my fault, and actually it's not me. So it's like there's still something I can do. In the same way that you're not able to have the voice that I have, I can, and I can say that. So I am saying that if you're out there listening and you know that you've not always done the right thing, or you know that you could help more, that we could help more, and we could all do a little bit more as blokes. This is a part of a collection, a part of a collective, where I always say the running community is so supportive and so strong and so bloody lovely. But that's from a man's point of view. And I know for a fact from mates who are women that it's not always like that. So we can try harder. And if we're all out there saying, oh, it's such a lovely community, then let's bloody make sure it is. Let's do all we can to make sure it is. And there's always more that all of us can do to help make that community what we say it is and what we'd like it to be.
Oh, that makes me want to say, like, be more Ben. That should be the catchphrase for the day.
But you mean nice Ben. You don't mean me, do you? Because you haven't told your listeners about the other thing about our run either, have you? No.
I haven't mentioned nice Ben. No, because that would look bad on you. So I didn't feel that we should touch upon that.
I think that looked bad on you lot. I mean, your listeners have just heard me sound great. So that was...
They have heard you sound great. Basically, for those who are listening, there were two Bens from Bristol who were running the Dragon's Back. And just so that we could kind of tell who we were talking about, the other Ben, aka not you, was Nice Ben from Bristol. That's just what he got called, which kind of made it sound like you weren't Nice Ben. But you are lovely,
that
Ben.
That only came around, was it day three or something, when he overtook us in the morning and one of you went, oh, there goes nice Ben from Bristol.
Right. Yeah, I can kind of see how you might have taken that now, yeah. Actually.
Oh, can you now? Thank you.
It was what we call, you know, it was banter. It was getting us all across the hills. It was fun, wasn't it?
It was fun, it was. And, you know, I mean, that's where it was. It was, I've been trying to explain this to people since, and I would suggest anyone who's listening, if you're still listening to you and me waffle on a rabbit on there, great. If you are thinking, I could never do that, I don't know about you, Laura, but I didn't think I could do this a couple of years ago. I didn't think I could do a hatchling. I sure as hell didn't think I could do a dragon's back complete race. And now I still think I'm going to give the dragon's back another go at some point. But I would suggest getting out there, because what gets you through isn't that self-determination, isn't that sort of single-minded, bloody-minded focus for most of us. I mean, there will be the elites out there who do that. But it was the camaraderie that we had, that banter and that absolute sense of, I've got your back, because the next minute I need you to help me. 10 minutes later I'll be helping you, and 10 minutes after that we'll be both helping someone else, and it just, that sense of the social side of things, I really hadn't anticipated it would be that strong and that important in that race. But it was probably the one thing I've taken away from the Dragon's Back for me, was just how important the social side of running is for me. I really, as someone who runs on their own nearly all the time, who likes being on their own, when I do park runs I rarely do them, but equally I'm always at the edge of a group in many ways. So I hadn't really embraced that side of things, but it changed it for me. And it was that brutal, funny banter at times where we were horrible to each other. I'm just going to put it out there, just so no one thinks we're both lovely people. We were quite mean to each other, which was great, but it helped us as well. I think it really helped. I wouldn't say it inspired me, your meanness or our collective meanness, but it kind of did.
That's so true, and I'm very much like you in that I love running by myself. I, you know, I'm very often on my own. I don't tend to run with a club. I maybe go out with a couple of people, you know, if they want to go running with me, but I run by myself a lot. So yeah, having that group and that camaraderie was lovely. And we were rude. We were really rude, but it was funny.
It really wasn't. I don't think I've ever sworn as much as I did that week, and it was great. It was funny. It was just honest. It was really honest. And hadn't you said to me beforehand, a month before, when you and I obviously we started talking online and sort of getting to know each other, and I think that was a really nice side of things. But had anyone said to me, oh, you're going to meet these four other people who you're going to spend most of the week with running together, I'd have said, absolutely no way am I signing up for that, because that's not what I'm doing it for. I don't want to meet anyone. Don't need any new running friends. I don't have any. That's fine. I'm quite happy with that. Now, I think everyone should go out and make some running buddies. And I think it's the best thing in the world. And I hate to say this to everyone, you and I have planned another run together. And we're all going to meet up at some point next month at some point. So it's really turned into this little collective Stockholm syndrome friendship group born out of both necessity, but also out of shared experience. It's just really lovely.
It's weird because turns out we actually do like each other, not just to get round Wales.
And I think that's, again, but I think a lot of people, what I've really taken from this is, and that whole classic, oh, I can do it, anyone can do it, but I really think I can. So I think that's something that's worth a lot of people saying and listening to, that if you are listening and thinking, oh, I'd like to try this, I'd like to give it a go, and it might be a 10K or a half marathon or ultra, it doesn't really matter. Crack on and give it a go, but don't forget, a big part of that training isn't just the right shoes or the right hydration, it's the right mindset, and a big part of that is being social. And for a long time, I don't know about you, Laura, but for a long time, I thought, I don't feel like a runner. I've started too late, I'm not quite the right shape, or I'm not as fast as him, or I don't look as good as what she does, and all these sorts of things. And I even look back and think, part of me thinks, did I start running at night so that I wasn't part of the social side of things? Because fewer people run at night. I was just more content being on my own. And I think I kind of embraced that solitude a little bit too much. But this sense of being sociable, I'm not saying you have to run with everyone every time and join thousands of other runners at every given moment. But just embrace the social side of it when you can. If someone says, do you want to go for a run together? My inclination would have always been to have said, nope, I'm busy, even if I had nothing planned at all. Whereas now, I'd quite happily go for a run with pretty much almost anyone, I think. And I think that's something that probably changed most of me. So yeah, if you're listening and wondering, can you do these things? Yeah, but I think embracing it wholly, and a big part of that is the social side, is really important.
That's really interesting, because I think everybody I've chatted to on this podcast has said that they don't feel like a runner in some capacity or other. Everybody seems to have that feeling. It doesn't matter where, you know, how high up the ranks they get or what level they're podiuming at. They all say, oh yeah, I'm not really a runner. I'm not a very good runner. I don't, you know, I'm not up there. And I'm like, yeah, you are. Like, I'm not a runner. So I think it's kind of indicative of how we think, isn't it? That none of us really think we're runners, but at the end of the day, we're all running.
Yeah, and I think I've changed that now. I know that it's because the Dragon's Back or around about the same sort of time, I'm definitely a bloody runner now. Not just that.
You're an athlete.
You told me that made you feel slightly sick when my colleagues referred to me as an athlete on day 5 or 6, whatever it was.
We did have a bit of a giggle. And I don't know what I think, because, you know, you were part of our group. You are part of our group. And so for them to be referring to you as an athlete, by default, kind of referred to us as athletes. And we just found that absolutely hysterical. Yeah. We were like, well, that's ridiculous. We're not athletes. We're just here, you know, actually now having quite a good time, weirdly, in a heat wave. We're not athletes, but maybe we are. Who knew?
I would say we are. I really would. And I don't think it's cock. I think maybe it's a British thing, but also it's the type of sport we do. And it is. But I was really reticent about saying the word sport or the word saying the word runner. And sure as hell wouldn't have ever embraced the word athlete before. But now I am an athlete who is a runner, and I do a particular sport. And I'm really happy to embrace that, because not because we've done a 6-day run across Wales to prove ourselves, but I think it stripped away all the insecurities for me. I remember, well, I don't know what sort of level of content you want on this show, Laura, but I remember about 3 days in, I was just farting out loud because I just didn't care anymore. Because if I needed to burp, I was just going to burp. I wasn't going to make myself uncomfortable because you were next to me. So I burped, I farted, I did whatever I had to do. Because you know what? It just made me more comfortable, and I didn't care if you did, or I'm not saying you did for any of your listeners, but I'm not saying Laura does or doesn't fart.
I never do.
But some of us in the group were very happy to communicate via that channel. But actually, you're stripping away these insecurities. Like, I'm not going to judge you if you fart next to me. I'm not going to judge you if you cry next to me, or if you F and blind, or you drink less, or you drink more. And you know what? You're bloody running. And I say this now where people say, oh, I'd love to do what you've done, but I'm not a runner. I thought you do park runs. Oh, yeah. And it's like, well, then you're a runner. Oh, right. It's like, with this whole sense of you're not a runner unless. It's like, unless what? Where do we stop? Is that unless you can do the Dragon's Back, unless you can win the Dragon's Back, unless you can do one of these awful desert runs that sounds horrific, like Death Valley or something? It never stops. And you can't imagine anyone doing, I mean, you and I have both done marathons as well. Would you describe yourself as a marathon runner? I think that's a really difficult one as well. You go, well, I've run marathons. Like, yeah, then you're a marathon runner. Oh, yeah, but I'm not you're not one of the ones that are at the front where there's a little motorbike in front of you filming every move. No, you're not one of those. The vast majority of people are one of those. Don't worry. And even those, do they say, well, I'm not a runner because I'm not, what's the new guy, Kiptum or Kipchoge or any of these amazing female runners as well? There's always someone better. But that doesn't mean you're any less of a runner or of a teacher or of whatever sort of career or identity you choose. Doesn't mean because you're not the best of the best, you're not anything. It's not all or nothing. So I think accepting that you are a runner, if you run, it doesn't matter how far you run, doesn't matter how well you run, doesn't even matter how often you run. I've got a mate who I run with who had major heart surgery a couple of years ago, cracked his chest open. We go for runs. It took him so long to say yes, he'd go for a run with me, because he said, I'll never keep up with you. So I know you won't, but I don't expect you to. And I don't want you to. I'd like to go for a run with you. And he goes, and he's a runner. And we only go once every month, 2 months, whatever it is now. He's a great runner. He's not as fast. He doesn't go as far, but he's out there running. I mean, who would look at that and say, well, you don't deserve that title? And the only people who do that are ourselves. So I know it took a long time to say that, but it's not weird in a way that all of your guests have said, I'm not a runner, because it doesn't help when you look at things like Nike or Adidas or even ASICS and sort of big brands, because all their runners are really lithe, typically young people, able-bodied who are absolutely hammering it up the Matterhorn at a pace that I couldn't run bloody on a flat. And you go, well, I'm not that person. But I think we've got this sense about, I'm not that person, then what am I? So, well, I can't identify as a runner then. So I think it's an advertising thing yet again that's affecting us. And obviously you work in PR, and I think the PR machine with sports is so good in so many ways. And yeah, I think they're missing a trick. If they enabled far more people to think of themselves as football players or swimmers or runners or hockey players, whatever, then they'd sell more, first of all. But actually, ultimately, we'd all be happier in the skin that we wear.
That's really interesting. It is about, there's a lot of this magnifying on the top people and not looking at the masses. And I think we then start to compare ourselves, don't we, with the wrong people in a way.
Absolutely. And I do have to say, even looking at the Dragons back, the imaging that came out all week and the stories that came out were very much who's in the lead, who's winning, how fast are they? And that's really important, part of the whole experience. But that wasn't the majority of people are doing that. The majority of people, by default, didn't win that race. And yet they're not accurately reflecting all the stories that are going on behind the scenes. And I know, obviously, you can't film all that. You can't do all that. But actually, I looked at that beforehand. I'd always look at all these videos that were going out. And I think they're so good. And I think the PR machine of something like Dragon's Back is brilliant. But it definitely is biased to those who are the fastest, who are the elites. And I get why. Mm. But actually, I think as an average long-distance runner, I'm still identifying as that, it didn't encourage me to run. I think if anything, it was like, well, I'm not going to be that person or one of those. Like, well, would I want to do that? I don't know. And I'm really cocky and arrogant and really stubborn. So I wonder if I wasn't quite as cocky, arrogant and stubborn, would I have still done that? But I think it's a narrative we all need to change within our community and celebrate that sense of most of the people who did that run were like me and you and Graham and Alison and Glaris. Average people who are in the middle of the pack, who found it hard, who were never going to win the top prize, sorry, but we bloody did it. We had a really bloody good go, and I'm proud of what we did. I think we should celebrate that side of all of these sports more than we currently do.
So true. And by the way, cocky, arrogant and stubborn is possibly why you weren't called Nice Ben from Bristol.
Of course.
Bit of a loaded question, this one. Do you think you form stronger bonds with people that you're thrown together with for 6 days on the Welsh mountains than you would other friends, perhaps?
I thought so, until you just still brought me back to that not being... I don't know. I do, actually. And I'm going to sound really bad. I hope no one I know is listening to this. Because when I got back, I do hang out with a bunch of friends from different groups quite regularly, and quite active groups as well. And I just felt like I was missing something for a few days, or a couple of weeks, actually, to start with. And it wasn't U4 that really annoyed me. And it wasn't just U4. It was Jay and Carmen with the accordion, and I could name a whole bunch of other people, because we'd gone through something that was really... I'm not going to ham this up and say it was terrible and it was life-defining, because it wasn't. It was... I think the sense of if you do the Dragon's Back or any of these big races, it'll change you for life. It shouldn't do, really. It should be the highlight of a year, maybe, or even 6 months, but it shouldn't define your life. But actually, what it does is force you into these really acute situations where us five, for example, were either really going to get on or we really weren't. We were very different people. I'm not going to talk about the others too much, but we were very different people from very different backgrounds with very different outlooks, and yet... it's fair to say I came away full of love for you, Gits. I really do.
You had to throw that word in there.
I had to actually taper it down what I was going to say. There was a real lot of love for you, helped me get across that line. And I know that I helped you, and I helped Alison, and she helped me, and we all helped each other. And I think that was really strong. So yeah, there is a sense of doing the race hasn't changed me or defined anything for me. But actually meeting you guys has been probably the best bit of that whole 6 days. And it sounds like I'm trying to be nice now and earn that title back. Like, I could maybe be the other Nice Ben from Bristol. Or...
I don't know. You've got a bit of work to do, Ben, to claw that one back.
Can I be the occasionally okay Ben from Bristol?
That sounds okay. We can go with that. Occasionally okay Ben.
But yeah, I think it does. I think it really throws you into these situations where we were going to come away going, what a lovely week. It was so nice to meet you. Like, delete her number, block her, never see her again. Or we talk quite regularly. We have a little WhatsApp group and we chat to each other and we'll say we're going to meet up soon and you and I are doing that stupid race in a few weeks' time. I think it's really thrown us together, and it's hard, I don't know about you, but it's hard to explain when you come back. It was very much, oh, that time when Graham did 777 so, oh, and it's so funny when Alison did that. Oh, I love it when Clara does this. It's like you've only just met these people and I'm talking about them like I've known them my whole life, and it's really annoying me because I know intimate details about all these people suddenly. And it's probably quite hard for family and friends when you come back to suddenly have a whole list of characters that you've never heard of, and suddenly that's all these people are talking about. So I don't know.
It is different to real life, isn't it? In that if I met somebody, you know, in my workplace or, you know, in town, and I came back and I started talking about them in that way, it's just not normal. Yeah, that's what I do with you guys now.
I don't think that's normal either.
Maybe not.
Thinking about our relationship as a five people group there is normal in any way, shape, or form. But it was really nice. And what really hit me was how many people said, it's so nice to see you five doing this, or we don't often see this. And I think there's a missing thing there somewhere, because if most people don't finish The Dragon's Back in its completion, then there's other things you can take away from that. If you're not going to come away as first, second, third, or even completing the whole thing, there's no shame in that whatsoever. I still ran further than I've ever run in a more difficult terrain than I could have ever anticipated. And yet, I think coming away with that social experience that we had that week was really lovely. And I would love it if more people had the opportunity to do that and make those bonds. Because it is, you get to an adult and it's hard to make bloody friends. It's going to sound sad now. When you're a kid, you walk into the playground and you just say, kind of a lick of, can I try that little tweak you've got, or can I have some of the ice cream? And yeah, you're away. As adults, you can't bond in the same way and make meaningful friendships in the same way that you do when you were a kid. And yet, I feel like I've come away with five really, really good friendships after that week, which is weird.
You are now part of the weirdest Fellowship of the Ring that, you know, ever existed. It's true. It was a bizarre, bizarre week, wasn't it? And I kind of still look back on it now. I mean, we're weeks gone now, and yeah, I miss it. I do really miss it.
I find myself every so often, I'd say daily still, flashing back to something that makes me smirk, or if something's annoying me, I'm in a Zoom meeting or I'm in a physical meeting and I'm just daydreaming a little bit, it'll be that day we just ran on those endless, endless boggy sort of terrain hills. It'll go back to there, we're on the road, or the bit when we were just scaling up something or down something, or just bitching and moaning about the weather yet again. And it's those sort of flashbacks all the time. And yeah, they'll dissipate and they will sort of become fewer and fewer. But it's still nice to have those, knowing they're going to be there. And that when you have them, they make you chuckle. With me, at least. I don't know about you, Laura, but I still smirk on nearly every time I remember something. Or because most of it was a fun experience. Most of it, as bad physically as a lot of it was.
I'm smirking frequently when I think about it. I really am.
It was just silly, and there were in-jokes, and the chance that the fact we had in-jokes and suddenly there was a backstory to some of these things, we had that time to do that, and it was completely indulgent. I know it was indulgent. We had the money to afford to be able to do that and the time to take off, and we're all able-bodied enough at the moment to be able to do these things, but that doesn't detract from the fact that we still went and bloody did it, first of all, but equally, it was largely a really lovely, fun, and... He said wholesome. It was a wholesome experience. It really was.
I think I'd like the takeaway for listeners maybe to be that they should have a go at these events, that maybe when they seem overwhelming at first, or, you know, inconceivable to ever complete these type of things, that actually you should just go for it if you want to try.
Absolutely. So since coming back, I mean, when I first came back, and it's probably the wrong time to think this, people kept going, oh, what's next? And I said, I don't need nothing. I'm going to run anymore. I'd torn the meniscus on one knee. I've got a couple of toenails that have since divorced me and left. I think I've got a blown quad on the other side as well. And my exhaustion was absolutely monumental. So I think the first 2 days, like, I think I might retire as an athlete. I might have to run in now. The worst thing, Laura, on day three, I signed up for bloody Cape Wrath Ultra. So that's 8 days running next year from Fort William up to Cape Wrath. I've signed up for a stupid trail marathon with you in December. I've spoken to Jay about doing a bloody run in Spain and Carmine about doing an 83 mile night run in Norfolk next December.
Sounds nuts, but brilliant.
A year ago, I would never have anticipated voluntarily doing all these things going, I've got a good chance of smashing this. I still don't know if I had, but what's more important, in the same way that you and I said, why not? I don't know if I can do these things, but I've got no reason to doubt myself anymore. I've got no reason to think, if I don't, I'm not less of a person. I'm not less of a runner. If I don't succeed, Christ, I don't succeed. But if I don't try, I won't know. So you've got nothing to... Okay, you've got nothing to lose apart from a couple of days and maybe some money to enter these races. But if you can afford both, then give it a go. Crack on.
Brilliant. And you might just get something a lot more back than you put in.
You might make some friends you never knew you needed.
Like some okay friends from Bristol.
Yep.
Listen, I think people could obviously listen to us waffling on for days on end. They have a great time, but probably we might have to take our conversation off air and catch up some other time and re-meet up with the fellowship. But it's been so good to catch up on this podcast, Ben. It's nice to talk to you again in a capacity when we're not, you know, sweating our asses off, quite frankly.
It is on that wonderful sum up of our power dynamic. It is nice to be talking, not sweating our asses off. Lovely. Yeah. Thanks, Laura.
We shall catch up very soon. Take care, Ben.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to leave a review for the Vegan Fitness Runner podcast. Please subscribe if you don't want to miss an episode. And remember, you can find out more about all my guests and further information on all the topics covered over on the website, veganfitnessrunner.com. Thanks again, and bye for now.